from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A recent report from the California Association of Realtors shows pending sales in the Bay Area dipped more than 10% between October 2015 and October 2016. And for California as a whole, the number of properties receiving multiple offers was down for the seventh straight month. Is the market cooling off? Well, we'll get the latest data on the region's housing market, including where home and rental prices are heading in 2017. Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. There are recent indications that the hyperactive Bay Area real estate market is slowing down. The California Association of Realtors reports that pending sales from October are down year over year in San Francisco by 21.2%, in Santa Clara County by 12.5%, and that it's a downward trend echoed throughout the region. And we want to take the pulse of the Bay Area real estate market in this hour and get some expert advice on what's in store for housing and rental prices in the new year. We're also going to hear about a new law taking effect January 1st that will make it easier to build a second unit on a property or to convert an illegal unit into a legal one. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. We want to welcome first by phone Selma Happ, who is with us from Los Angeles. She's chief economist with the Pacific Union International. We welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have here in studio Christopher Palmer with us. He's assistant professor with the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Welcome.
Happy to be back.
Glad to have you. And Kathleen Pender is also here, business columnist, Net Worth is a column, San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome back, Kathleen Pender.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let me begin, Selma Happ, with you because you've done a lot of very fine detailed work in terms of research, looking at zip codes and depreciation and prices. And what we see is a softer market, but we also see kind of a diminished buyer craze. So the market is softening, and also there's smaller premiums that buyers are going to pay as well.
Yes, so what I saw in most recent analysis that's using the data year to date, so January to October, was that we really see a bifurcation in the market between high end market and lower end market. So where the cooling, or what you would call cooling, I would be likely to refer to it as normalization, because the high end of the market was so hot for the last few years. But the normalization was primarily in the higher end market, and that was in the San Francisco and Silicon Valley. But where we saw continued high price appreciation, and to some degree still relatively more bidding going on, was in the relatively more affordable area of the East Bay, so Alameda, Contra Costa, and to some degree Sonoma.
But you also kind of extrapolated from this data that there's a great deal of uncertainty, that we're in kind of a pause, maybe because of buyer fatigue or because of the ceiling level of what people are willing to pay or able to pay.
Yes, so I think, throughout the year, what we have seen is buyer cooling. And by that I mean fewer homes are selling over the asking price, and fewer homes are actually being sold over the asking price and at the lower premium. And that's been a continuing trend throughout the year and throughout most of the Bay Area. Now, what was interesting in November, though, we saw some reversal of trends. We had a really strong sale month for November, where sales were 10% higher than last November. And this is, after months, all the months throughout 2016, we've seen decline year over year. And so November came in really strong. And also what happened was a monthly decrease, so decrease between October to November, which usually averages 16% over the last 4 years, has now only declined by 6%. So that's one interesting point. The other is that, again, we saw some pickup of home sellers activity in those more expensive markets, such as the Silicon Valley and the city, San Francisco City. So I think, you know, mortgage rates, changes in mortgage rates, and maybe what everything else, the heating of the economy, and to some degree, you know, the stronger consumers' confidence that we've seen over the last few months may have contributed to this reversal of trends.
Let me remind you that Selma Happ is with us on the line from Los Angeles. She is chief economist with the Pacific Union International. And Christopher Palmer is here in studio. He's assistant professor with the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. And are we talking about mainly high-end softening?
So we do see a lot of softening at the high end of the market. Let me tell you a quick anecdote from my students this last semester. I had an MBA student who lives in downtown in what you would call a Class A unit, and his lease comes up for renewal every year, and his landlord, like clockwork, shows up to increase his rent and sign a new lease. And this year, landlord kind of showed up hat in hand saying, you know, what would it take to get you to stay and not move, which was quite a departure. I have another PhD student lives in a much more modest apartment, and he, after years of not having any rent increases, his landlord came and doubled the rent. So there's a very competitive market that's just not competitive at the tight high end of the rental market right now.
And you're a man who opposes rent control. You've said any reasonable economist, I believe, should oppose rent control.
That is the broad consensus among economists, I will say.
Well, we'll talk about the rental market in the course of the hour, too. But this whole sense of the market softening or the market changing and everything, it comes down in many ways to the tech sector, doesn't it?
It does. There's a high exposure in San Francisco to the tech sector. And so any question of whether the music can continue to play depends on how much runway we think the tech sector has. That said, it's a little bit of a misnomer to talk about the tech sector. At this point, we really have tech companies, so-called tech companies that are logistics companies and transportation companies and food service companies, financial services, manufacturing companies, but they all kind of use technology, and that's the common thread. So we like to lump them together.
And Kathleen Penner, let me bring you into this because we've got new state laws that are going to make some real changes in this market too, governing second units specifically.
Yes. I don't think a lot of people realize this, but the governor signed three bills this year that are going to make it easier to create a second unit on your property, even in districts zoned residential, residential one, single family homes.
We've even changed the language. We're now calling them accessory dwelling units.
Right. ADUs. Yeah. What the state laws do in a very complicated fashion is they're going to eliminate or alleviate the additional parking requirements that most cities and counties impose when you try to build an in-law or granny unit. And they will also reduce or eliminate the utility hookup fees that utilities normally charge. So it should be easier and cheaper to build these. It still won't be easy or cheap, but it could create some kind of middle income units, which has been sorely needed in the Bay Area. It's probably not going to be enough to solve our housing shortage, but it could put a dent in it.
It's also what kind of dent, I suppose, would be the question.
Well, that remains to be seen. We don't really know. No one seems to know how many homeowners will actually take advantage of this and attempt to do it. One drawback is that the construction business is going great guns right now. I talked to one woman who wanted to build a unit in her home, and she talked to three architects, and they all had a one-year backlog. So I think that could actually be the big holdup, is just finding architects and contractors.
There's also a pretty confusing set of regulations here. There are a lot of gray areas.
Right? Well, the state department that governs this is in the process of coming out with guidelines that hopefully will make it easier to understand. But then each city and county is going to have to amend their local second unit ordinances to come into compliance with the state law. And if they're not in compliance by January 1st, the state law will take over, and the state law is much more friendly to second unit creation than a lot of cities and counties have been in the past.
Kathleen Pender with us in studio, business columnist of Net Worth in the San Francisco Chronicle. Let me go back, Selma Happ, to you, and she's again chief economist with Pacific Union International. What about the interest rates? I mean, we haven't even brought that up yet. How do you see that playing? About the highest since 2013, I think.
Yeah, so we saw a 50 basis point increase since the election, and I think rates are continuing to creep up, particularly in light of the tomorrow's meeting, the FOMC meeting, where the expectations is that the Feds are going to increase the rates, and that will further push mortgage rates up. Now, I think partially why we did see strong November is because of the mortgage rates and because they started creeping up, and those people that have been considering entering the market, you know, may have been nudged to do so. Now, what is that going to do to, you know, if we think about what's going to happen to mortgage rates throughout 2017 and how that is going to affect the market. You know, the expectation again is the mortgage rates are going to continue going up, and you know, by expert estimates, it's anywhere between 4.5 and 4.75 by the end of next year. When we look at how much that affects affordability, for example, $1 million home in the Bay Area. Currently, 25% of households can afford that in the Bay Area. If the interest rates go up 1 percentage point, we are losing about 5% of households, and that's about 127,000 households. So, you know, definitely, and again, this is at the higher end, so the median price is $1 million and above in the Bay Area. But when we look at the lower priced market, so where the price appreciation has been strong, and the median home prices are between $500,000 and $700,000, I think that that population of buyers is going to be much more sensitive to increase in mortgage rates. And so I am concerned about what is that going to do to further decrease affordability in the Bay Area.
Well, there may be some skepticism, and I want you to address this, if you could, to that statistic you gave us about 25% being able to afford $1 million home?
Well, I'm quoting the statistic that was done by John Burns Consulting, and they dwelled really deep into income distribution in the Bay Area. There's various estimates of income distribution, and some say that there's only, you know, about 15% of households, Claritas, I'm quoting Claritas, that's another source of household income distribution data, that only 15% of households earn above $200,000. I think, you know, it's household income, but maybe also discretionary income and other sources of income as well that they were looking at.
Including maybe parental income. And speaking about other sources
Absolutely.
Of income, let me go to you, Christopher Palmer. What about foreign buying? Where are we now at that? And foreign money coming into this housing market? There was certainly a lot of flags raised about that in the past.
So we often think that a checking account is kind of the safest place for our money. But if your checking account happens to be in yuan or in rupees or in rubles, then your checking account actually looks pretty risky relative to owning something like land in the Bay Area. And so that's been a reason why the Bay Area is seen as a safe haven for foreign buyers that like to park a lot of their investment money here. The interesting thing is that kind of read the tea leaves on these emerging markets, and we try to say, well, would we be at risk then if they had a downturn? And the interesting thing is that when times are good there, or when times are bad there, it still looks advantageous to park capital here. And so we're likely to continue to see interest from abroad.
Median home buyer age I saw in the United States is 36. It's different here, isn't it?
It is different here. So almost half of Bay Area households are renting households. And so let's just pause for a minute and remember that when they hear stories like this on the radio, they lick their lips a little bit. Those that want to buy a home, they're kind of watching house prices growing faster than their savings, if you will, and would love to have an entry point. And they cheer when they hear news of a cooling. It gives them hope.
And what about hope for renters? What do you see in terms of the trajectory for renters at this point?
So let's note, for example, that that cooling at the high end is in part the market doing what it's supposed to do. So a lot of our supply response, a lot of the units that we've put in place, as difficult as that is in the Bay Area over the past few years, have been at that upper end of the market. And that's kind of where you can recover your investment. That's becoming less true with the uptick in vacancies and the increase in concessions that we see in high-end apartments. And so developers now that are looking to recover their investments and justify paying high construction costs and high land costs are going to look at building more workforce housing. There's also an insatiable appetite among for affordable housing development. So developers like Bridge Housing just can make as many deals as they have bandwidth to make because there's a long line out the door for every single affordable housing unit in the city.
And you've given what I think of as some sage advice, especially about people who are, well, maybe concerned about what you call the stress test. I'm talking about the mobility with jobs and employment.
Sure.
People are moving in and out all the time. They're more moving out than moving in. But nevertheless, take your assets and look at them from that perspective.
Yeah, so it's an analogy I like to make. So with the Dodd-Frank Act, we now make our biggest banks in the country stress test themselves, where they say, how would they fare under various adverse scenarios? What if unemployment rate spikes or we had another foreclosure crisis? How would Wells Fargo's book of business perform under that scenario? Well, each of us can do that with our own family. We can say, well, how would I perform if I didn't get that raise that I'm counting on, or if my kids didn't move out of the house, or if my parents did move back into the house, or if we don't get this promotion? And we can say, well, how would I fare during that situation? That might either give us confidence that we're doing all right, or it might encourage us to make some different decisions and plan for a rainy day.
And again, Christopher Palmer is assistant professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Kathleen Pender is business columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. Her column is called Net Worth. And let's go back to these granny units, as they're called, or the new name for them, accessory dwelling units. We've got a lot of questions. I mean, especially with the easing of off-street parking and the cost of utility, these are big questions as well. I mean, it may change, as you say, may put a dent in, but they have to be faced in part of the whole calculus of this.
Yeah, well, like I said, the promise of these is for people who are making too much to afford a below market rate unit. And they're making not enough to afford a market rate unit like all the new luxury condos and apartments that are being built.
So this could help seniors, for example, right?
Yeah, or just maybe young people who don't work in the tech sector, people who work for nonprofits, people maybe with a small families with a child, they might actually be able to afford a cottage in someone's backyard.
Or someone who maybe parents would be able to build that cottage in their backyard.
Well, a lot of the people I spoke to who are building these or interested in building them are actually using them as granny units. I have a big house. I don't need it anymore. My kids are living in a mobile home. They can come live in the big house. I'll live in the backyard. I can babysit the kids while they're at work. Or people who are maybe widowed or divorced, they're living in a big home by themselves, they're having trouble making the mortgage payment, they can turn maybe their master bedroom suite into a rental unit and get a little extra income to help pay the mortgage.
And it's more, with these new laws, it's going to be easier to make an illegal unit into a legal one after January 1st.
Theoretically, we'll see how that plays out. Many cities and suburbs especially have been kind of hostile to second units because they don't like, you know, they don't want renters, they don't want more people parking. But that's really beginning to change. And some of the areas that have opposed this in the past are actually kind of really embracing it. I know San Jose's already got their new second unit
ordinance. It's ironic, though, the states are somewhat more permissive in some instances, right?
Well, the state sees this as a solution that, you know, it's easier when you're the state to say these people should do it as opposed to when you're, say, a city council person who might have, you know, your constituents calling up and saying, I can't find parking in my neighborhood anymore.
I know there are many of you out there with questions about housing and about the market, and so let me give you a phone number you can call if you want to bring these questions to our panel. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to call us now with any questions or comments you might have about the housing market and supposedly the softening or some signs of cooling of that housing market, especially on the high end. Again, we welcome your phone calls, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways to join the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Panel includes Selma Hepp, chief economist with Pacific Union International, Christopher Palmer, assistant professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, and Kathleen Pender, business columnist of Net Worth with the San Francisco Chronicle. And if you want to go out on a limb here and talk about what this housing market is going to be like under a Trump administration, Kathleen, you have some thoughts about that.
Well, it's very hard to predict because there's definitely some positives and some negatives. As Selma said, mortgage rates have jumped up about 0.5 percentage point since the election. The thought is that Trump will increase infrastructure spending without paying for it, and that could increase GDP, the economy, more income, more jobs. That would be good for people trying to buy a home if you have more income. On the other hand, it's pushing interest rates up, and that's a negative factor. If Trump makes good on his promise to deport undocumented immigrants and build a wall, we could have fewer people here, and immigrants have made up for a big part of our population growth. If we have fewer immigrants, we'll have less demand for housing, particularly rental housing. That could cause rents to come down. If rents come down, maybe people who are thinking about buying might decide to keep renting. That could bring prices down. There's just a whole lot of factors at play here, and it's
a lot of uncertainty, though.
Yes, yeah. There's positives and negatives on both sides, and part of it depends on what he actually does and then how people respond to that.
Anything you want to add here, Professor Palmer?
Yeah, so first of all, on the uncertainty, I think that plays out in the California Association of Realtors report. We see fewer sales and fewer multiple bids because I think both buyers and sellers are taking more of a wait-and-see approach with the uncertainty on the horizon. Sellers want a return to that hot market that they were looking at when they were planning on listing their home, and buyers want to see if there's going to be a little bit of a downturn. I'll also just add on interest rates that normally the effect of interest rates, rising interest rates, is not so terrible because it is a happens in lockstep with an improving economy. It's unlikely that the inflation that we're anticipating on the horizon is going to accompany a improving economy because we're feeling like with our unemployment rate where it is nationally and in the Bay Area, we're unlikely to see that much of an improvement in the economy. So one of my colleagues at Cal has called this a sugar high. And as the father of little kids, I know one thing about sugar highs is they have a hard landing afterwards. So you have a little bit of a frenzy and hyperactivity, and it's not clear that that's a long-term solution to the economy.
Well, let's hear from our economists on this. Selma Hepp, let's have you weigh in.
Yeah, so I would just like to take it back to what really initially the problem in the Bay Area housing market was before even the election, and that's the lack of inventory. And that has not been resolved. So, and that's going to continue to be our biggest problem, irrespective of what happens with the Trump administration.
Actually, forgive me, Selma, I'm looking at a tweet here from a listener who says, you can't talk about Bay Area real estate, especially on the peninsula, without starting with lack of inventory.
Yes. Exactly. So I would agree with that listener, and I think that's something that we need to spend much more time talking about, the reasons around why we have such a lack of inventory versus really what's going to, how the Trump administration is going to affect this, but not to say that it wouldn't. Now, what my concern is sugar high, yes. We're talking about equity markets, going to incredibly high levels, and people trading on expectations of something that's going to happen, and we don't even know that any of it is going to happen. And so what is going to happen post the sugar high? That's one of my biggest concerns right now. Now, if Trump, in fact, there is infrastructure spending and cutting taxes and all leading to inflation, and then on the other hand, deregulation, he mentioned tearing down the Dodd-Frank regulation, and what I'm concerned is what is going, if we may be going back to some degree to what we saw in 2006.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're coming up on a break. When we return, though, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Stay tuned. We're talking about the Bay Area housing market. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A recent report from the California Association of Realtors shows that pending sales in the Bay Area dipped 11.6% between October 2015 and October 2016. And for California as a whole, the number of properties receiving multiple offers was down for the seventh straight month from 63% to 59%. And we're going to get in this hour, we've already gotten a lot of the latest data on the region's housing market, including where home and rental prices are heading. Have a whole panel with us, Selma Hepp, Chief Economist for the Pacific Union International, and Christopher Palmer, Assistant Professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, and Kathleen Pender, Business Columnist for the Chronicle. Selma Hepp, we had to go to a break there, and you were finishing a thought, so I'm sorry I had to interrupt you, but the break stopped for no one, least of all me. So if you want to finish your thought, please.
Oh, sure. No problem at all. I was just referring to the regulation, the expectations around Trump administration, the regulating some industries, and particularly, referring to Dodd-Frank. And so what I'm afraid of is if we do see the inflation that is expected, and which will push prices further and reduce affordability down more, then, you have this a large share of population that can't afford, and now we're going to start pushing the boundaries of the housing finance and who can qualify. And so I'm just worried what that is going to do to alternative types of lending.
Well, you've expressed very cogent your anxieties. Let me I'm sure we'll hear from some listeners about what they're anxious about or what they're concerned about, as well as questions they may have. Let me go to the listeners, and let's go first to you, Jeff. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. So I live in the South Bay, or I live in Santa Cruz County, and I commute over the hill to San Jose and into Woodside even. I've been in the area for 5 years. I've been working six days a week on average. I bring in about $60,000 a year, and I live in one of these grandparents' units. But the $17,25 a month. For that, I can barely survive. I have a 10-month-old, and we both can barely make it in this economy, in this area. I don't know what we're going to do next, but I think we might have to move.
What would you say, Kathleen Pender, in the way of advice to someone like Jeff?
Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but some people might have to move. And that's, you know, I guess if you care about the Bay Area remaining a diverse, vibrant place with lots of different types of people and income levels, that's too bad. But I think all individuals have to make a personal decision. And I think some people will, and they have made decisions to move elsewhere. The question is then who's going to be around, you know, to do the jobs that non-tech people are needed to do.
Big question indeed. And Jeff, good luck to you. Thank you for calling. Let me bring some more callers on here. And we go next to Javier. Morning. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me. So I live in San Francisco, and I can't really say a specific area because of the situation is I'm boondocking, which the housing crisis has forced me out of my apartment 2 years ago, forced me to buy a truck camper, and I've been boondocking ever since. So what I'm shocked at is the rise of more boondockers, more people living in their vehicles and purchasing more RVs and living around San Francisco. I'm also shocked that despite the lack of housing, they're building a brand new multi-mega-million-dollar Warrior Stadium, and everybody just turns a blind eye. That kind of thing really upsets me. The city needs more.
I wouldn't
housing.
Say everybody turns a blind eye. There were big battles going on.
I don't think big enough. I don't think anywhere near big enough. Everyone just says, well, you know, you're going to have to move, like the recent response, and that is just so callous and cruel. We really need to stop saying, well, you know, the cities change, people grow. If you can't afford living here, then you got to go. Because the city can't live without us working here. And when we go, then what's going to happen? They're going to blame somebody else, and keep coming up with excuses.
Well, I take those comments of yours, Javier, certainly as an editorial comment, we'll take them under advisement, and I wish you good luck. I'm sorry that you're having this difficulty. Certainly, the calls are coming in suggesting that the housing market may be softening, but the problems are still pervasive and all too pervasive. Here's a listener, Andrew, who writes, as a person trying to purchase a single-family home over the last 6 months, I have found that every open house I have been to has been packed with people. I'm primarily looking at homes within the range of $500,000 to $700,000 near SFO in Oakland. Until single-family homes start being built again, I feel that I will always be competing with dozens of other buyers. There's a problem of inventory again, Christopher Palmer. It keeps coming up.
There is. There's a line out the door for a lot of units, especially in the most competitive market segments. And let's remember that it took us something like 30 years to get into this affordability mess. And so one month of cooling data is not going to unravel all of this. And trying to figure out a way out of this is going to have to be a long-term solution to a long-term problem. And unfortunately, for many of us, we'd like to see results now.
And before I go to more calls, I want to read another comment from a listener named Jake who says, let me go to you on this, if I may, Selma Hepp. Many older areas of the Bay Area refuse to allow any new housing. A classic example is Woodside, which has the most room but fights tooth and nail against any housing growth. Extremely rich people are the primary reason for the Bay Area's housing problem because they all have the attitude of not in my backyard. A comment, Selma Hepp, on the NIMBY?
Oh, my goodness. I think, you know, when I was referring earlier to something we need to really seriously start talking about is the NIMBYism, is the fact that, you know, this prior to listeners talked about lack of affordable housing and where they're going to go, where, in fact, the biggest problem lies in the current residents of the Bay Area, which are unwilling to face the problem and do anything about it. Now, you know, I understand, you know, you have a big home and you may not want to have a multifamily housing right next door to you, but, you know, then we're going to continue facing these issues, and it's going to become even more pronounced, because I don't think that the cooling that we're seeing right now, as we talked about, is on the high end. I don't think we're going to be seeing any cooling on the lower end of the market anytime soon.
And I'm going to bring more of your calls on here. Let me go next to Kazoo in San Jose. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. What a great program. My question is, if you are someone who has a so-called illegal unit in the back of your house, and you want to come into the light with it now that the regulations are softening, what risk do you run at having to tear down your unit if, you know, you're not in compliance and whatnot?
Yeah, Kathleen Pender.
Well, I think that's going to depend on where you live. But when I was writing my story, one person suggested what you should do is go into your planning and zoning office and talk to them, find out, without identifying yourself or your address. Just go find out, you know, what the rules are, what would happen if you tried to do this. And I think some cities may be a lot more receptive than others, especially, you know, after what happened with the ghost ship fire and people living in unsafe conditions. I think cities should embrace homeowners who want to come in and turn an illegal unit into a legal unit. Of course, you're going to have to bring it up to code and make it safe, but I think that would just be great for all involved. So I don't think you should be afraid to broach this with your city.
And good luck. Thank you, Kazoo. And we're going to go right to another caller from San Leandro. Max joining us. Max, welcome to the program.
Hi. I want to talk about mobile home parks and RV and trailer parks in the Bay Area and all around California. I live at Trailer Haven in San Leandro, which was just taken over by a massive corporation, Cascade Corporate Management. And the first thing they did was send a letter out, you know, we are raising your rents and we're going to start charging for the contaminated well water. They didn't say contaminated, but it is. Contaminated well water and sewer, et cetera, tons of fees and raising other fees so that it's between, suddenly, one fell swoop, 25 to 36% higher depending on different people, different spaces. So immediately a bunch of people in RVs have left because it's just not, you know, doable for them. And those of us who own our homes and have plowed, you know, tens of thousands of dollars into our homes and the continued maintenance and so on, we are now left with, for every $100 of rent or fees that they raise it, our home values have dropped $10,000 per $100. So in one fell swoop, $20,000 to $30,000 down. Now, they don't deal with, I'm looking at raw sewage outside my window right now that they've refused to be dealing with over time, from cracked pipes dating back to the 1930s. And, you know, it's just what's happening all over the Bay Area. They're doing it just because they can.
Can I ask you, Max, what you're going to do in the wake of all what you've described here?
You know, this is a long, long-term economic plan for me to put the money in up front with my family, and I was having trouble finding a rental with my children. So the good thing coming here was that, well, there were families, so I could do it, right? But we made a sudden change in plans since economics here have been so completely upended anyhow, and we're moving back to Berkeley. We've found some really human landlords, and we're moving in January. We're some of the very few luckier ones. I had a little bit of savings from a little bit of inheritance from my father when he passed. But, you know, most people here don't have even that leeway. And, you know, I've got money that'll last a couple of years, you know. We just have to, who knows what we're going to be doing. We're going to be scrambling like everybody.
Well, I wish you good luck in the scramble, the situation you described is one that probably is all over the state. Christopher Palmer, want to comment?
Yeah, so we've had tremendous job growth, which is fantastic, and that puts also a side effect is it puts tremendous pressure on people that have been living here for a long time and are not participating in those rapidly increasing wages and rapidly increasing jobs. And so we have this affordability crisis, and I'll just mention at this point that our housing safety net is probably the worst of our social safety nets in this country. So if you qualify for food stamps or if you qualify for Medicaid, you get food and you get healthcare. And in America, if you qualify for federal housing assistance, you might get on a waiting list. And several years later, you might get off of that waiting list and you might be able to find an apartment that will satisfy the needs of your family.
Again, that uncertainty looms over all of this. Kathleen Pender, what about generally the mobile home trailer parks, though?
Well, I'm not an expert at all on mobile home parks and what the regulations are, but I think what the caller is experiencing is the same thing that all renters are experiencing in terms of in areas without rent control. People have gotten rent increases that are maybe up to twice what they had been paying, and that's what led to five cities in November had rent control measures on their ballot for the first time in the Bay Area, including some suburbs that you would be very surprised to learn had rent control initiatives, including San Mateo, Burlingame, Mountain View, Alameda, and Richmond for the first time. And in two of those five cities, the voters approved rent control.
And why... Christopher Palmer, are you and so many economists opposed to rent control? Can I get you on the record on that?
Sure. Well, so first of all, the knee-jerk reaction towards rent control as a fast solution that works at scale is completely understandable. People want results now. I think one of the main problems with it is that it's not means-tested. So it's a quick and dirty solution, and it's not guaranteed to be going to the right people. So undoubtedly, some of the people that we want to be able to preserve in our communities, our kids or our parents or our teachers or our firefighters are able to stay in their units provided they can afford them now. It doesn't improve affordability for anyone. It keeps it from getting worse. And then also sometimes you have situations where you have landlords eking out a living that are subsidizing six-figure income tenants. And so that's particularly egregious when you see those kind of examples.
Well, let me thank Max for her call. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. But let me go back to Selma Hepp, if I may, Selma, and read a comment from a listener who says, this is Laura who writes, I can't go anywhere in the Bay Area without seeing large apartment buildings in process everywhere, especially Oakland. So What do we see? I mean, it's true. Construction seems to be ubiquitous. What about the apartment inventory?
Well, you know, that's an interesting comment because, you know, Bay Area or California in general has been undersupplied for the last, 30 years. And there was a report done by a legislative analyst office that looked at how much housing we would need to keep up at the same level of price growth as the rest of the country, so lower price growth, and show that it was the lack of new construction that has led to this high price appreciation. So while, you know, to add to Chris's comment, you know, while we have had an incredible income growth and job growth in the Bay Area, we have, by the same token, been for 30 years undersupplying housing. So even though there has been, you know, a little bit more rental housing going on, that has been, again, on the higher end. So the lower end of the more affordable rental market is still incredibly undersupplied.
Well, here's a listener, Gabe, who says this distinction about the so-called high end of the market is interesting. With home prices in more traditionally affordable areas like the East Bay continuing to increase, aren't we just seeing a bigger, higher end of the market? Large areas of Oakland that were once attainable for middle-class folks are now out of reach. Aren't we really just seeing affordable housing evaporate? Well, I'll let the comment stand and let me go to more of your calls.
I have a comment about
go
that.
Ahead.
That was a big reason.
I was waiting with bated breath. Go ahead.
That was a big reason for the rent control measure in Richmond, is that people who are getting priced out of Oakland are moving to Richmond, and they're pricing out the people who live in Richmond. And Richmond is figuratively and literally the end of the line because it's the last BART stop. So if you want to work in the Bay Area and take BART to work, you can't go farther than Richmond. And so, yeah, it's just everyone's, it's the, yeah, the high end is just spreading out from kind of the more traditional, quote unquote, luxury areas that we've thought of.
Let me follow that up with you, Kathleen Pender, with a question from Bradley, because we've been talking about these second units. He says, I live in Alameda, which has a very explicit and strict second unit prohibition on lot size, a quarter of an acre and smaller. Will the new state law include these very typical and small lots? Are there any loopholes left for the municipalities to stop the law?
There are absolutely loopholes left. And
as with most state laws.
Yeah, cities can still, within the state law, impose various types of restrictions on lot size, although the law the state law will allow units up to 1,200 feet. Cities can impose smaller square footage requirements on the second unit. They can even outlaw them in areas if they think that the second units there would pose a public safety or health problem or impede traffic flow. So it's going to remain to be seen what sort of restrictions cities still impose.
And I think Dan from Oakland is on point here. Dan, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for the discussion this morning, all of you. I am one of those fortunate folks who does have a single-family home in Oakland, and we're very concerned because the Oakland City Council passed an ordinance last year that not only conforms with the state, but also makes it really sort of a wide-open time for everybody to turn their single-family homes into duplexes. And, of course, at the same time, there's no financing for new inspectors to make sure that these things are going to be safe. And after seeing what happened with the ghost ship fire and the lack of inspection, we now are opening up our entire city to the same problem in residential areas. Also, we're concerned about neighborhood cohesion because the more people that move in who don't have investment and move out who don't have investment in our neighborhood, the harder it is to have good neighborhood watches and the kinds of knowledge of each other that really make a difference.
Thank you for the call. We'll take that again as a comment, and I'm looking at a question from Eric who wants to know, do your guests see anything for the future prices in the outskirts of the Bay Area, and particularly Brentwood?
I don't have a precise forecast on for Brentwood at my fingertips, but I think a key question for people in these outlying areas is, are they going to be kind of the last to get to the party and the first to leave the party in the sense of they're kind of finally seeing a lot of price appreciation and they're going to be the first to turn, or are they going to be steadier? And I think that's an open question.
And let me go back, if I may, Selma Hepp, to you, because a lot of your research did focus or kind of laser in on specific Bay Area regions, and I wanted to have our listeners find out what that is all about. I mean, the biggest decrease I believe you found was in Silicon Valley, but also the East Bay and a few places in a few spots in Marin. But appreciation has gone on, particularly in Oakland and Berkeley, like up to 10-20%, hasn't it?
Yes. Well, even in the excess of 10-20%, some areas have even appreciated 40% rate, which is incredible. But I think what we, what the analysis showed is that, you know, the areas where we, with accessibility, I think two important things, accessibility and affordability. And so those areas that had accessibility to jobs tended to appreciate more. And so, you know, we're talking about outlying areas, and they usually are the last to come to the party, as you said, and as we saw in the last housing bubble or crisis, is that, you know, those areas appreciated at the end and then depreciated the fastest first. You know, the area with accessibility, actually my research, I was in Washington, D.C. at the time when I was doing my PhD research and looked at the foreclosure crisis and accessibility, and it showed that areas that had more accessibility to jobs and transit were less likely to go into foreclosures than areas that were further from had less accessibility.
This is, though, let me go back to you, if I may, Christopher Palmer, this is and remains the most expensive rental market and the most expensive home market in the country.
So we do see a lot of pressure, especially in coastal markets around the country. So Portland and Seattle are dealing with their own housing crunches right now. Vancouver actually is arguably more expensive than San Francisco in many respects. So there are other very expensive areas. But the Bay Area house prices and rents tend to be high for, I would say, at least three reasons. One, it's a high amenity place. People want to live here. Two, living here gives you access to participating in this labor market, which is, again, one of the best labor markets in the world right now. And three, people expect that to continue into to grow. So there's this expectations element where people are willing to pony up and squeeze and tighten their belts to get into a home here because they expect that to be a safe investment.
And Leslie writes, owning a house is not just about the mortgage payments. The taxes on a $1 million house are quite significant and are never paid off. Taxes are high in California. And Joseph says, can the high school professor talk about the data and tease out how housing prices decline when interest rates go up? What does the correlation coefficient look like?
So that's actually an ongoing project of mine. The challenge there is that generally, again, when interest rates go up, it's accompanied with economic growth. That's kind of one of the reasons that that we see inflation is because the economy's hot and things are going well. And so generally, when we see interest rates go up, we don't see outright price declines because the economy is going well. Now, this time, we definitely are anticipating a market reduction in affordability for a first-time buyer who's facing inflation, not a lot of economic growth because we're already at kind of peak capacity and full employment, accompanied with higher interest rates.
But you've said, I believe, that even though inflation is likely, you're not all that concerned about interest rates?
So I think that it seemed the consensus would be right now where interest rates are around 4.1, 4.2% foreign change. By the end of next year, interest rates could be around 5%, 5.2% kind of at most is what we're thinking of right now. And it seems like that is not going to be the biggest barrier for the majority of people looking to own a home here. It's the high cost of home, not necessarily that incremental interest rate change.
Again, Christopher Palmer is assistant professor at the High School of Business, UC Berkeley, and Kathleen Pender is business columnist for the Chronicle. You want to add something here, Kathleen?
Well, yeah. One thing people do when interest rates go up is that they switch to adjustable rate mortgages or interest only mortgages. So there are ways that even if the stated 30-year fixed rate goes up, people just switch into more affordable mortgage types.
And here is another caller, Jerry. Josh. Good morning. Yash.
Hi.
I'm struggling with your name here. What is your name? Yash?
Yash, yes.
Yash, okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
My question is, Vancouver, Canada, like law, which promotes local population living in the homes versus investment homes, how much is that pushing up the market, if you guys can comment on that?
Do you know, Selma Happ, can you help us here?
Well, yeah, I mean, Canada has different property rights laws than U.S. does. So, while there has been some push, particularly in New York City, where there was a lot of investment going on in high-end properties that could not be – the source of funding could not be validated or figure out where it's coming from, they try to implement some level of owner occupancy requirement. But we haven't seen any of that in the Bay Area yet.
Let me thank the caller and go to a question from Dan who wants to – well, he says, I'm curious what is meant by single-family home. Are we talking about something with a yard or are we talking about row houses? What about a condominium that's part of a larger three-story apartment building? Kathleen Pender?
Well, I think a single-family home is usually one home on one lot. And I know one of the callers said something about we need to increase the supply of single-family homes. That's really just not going to happen in the Bay Area because there's no space to do that. All of the construction that you're seeing is multifamily housing, and that's going to be the wave of the future. You could say often a condo that you own is technically a single-family home, even though it's in a multifamily building. But I think people who are looking to see some sort of increase in the traditional single-family home with a yard and a picket fence, that's just not going to happen anywhere near San Francisco.
And we're going to go to another of your calls. We'll welcome Jerry. Jerry, you're on.
I disagree a little bit about the interest rate. If I were a buyer today, I would hope that interest rates were 10%. Low interest rates favor sellers because they're interested in the price of the house. Buyers are interested in what they can afford. So if interest rates, as an example, were, I go to an extreme when I say 10%, if they were 10%, sellers would have to reduce the price of their home in order to sell the house. Buyers, on the other hand, would still be faced with only what they could afford. So at 10%, they could afford, let's say they could afford $3,500 a month. It would remain the same whether it were 10% or 5%. they would gain another advantage by their property taxes being reduced and their down payment being reduced because the price of the house would be lower. And again, I think interest rates play a large, large part in the rapid escalation of prices throughout the country.
Jerry, let me find out what Christopher Palmer thinks of your logic here, Professor Palmer.
So certainly I would say that over the long run, an increase high interest rates in general, tamping down the affordability and accessibility of mortgage credit for many people could, say, slow down the acceleration in house prices. I see that as a silver lining instead of a dominating effect. So I don't think that high interest rates are going to make it better for a buyer. I think on the margin, the fact that high interest rates are going to lead to lower prices is going to cushion the blow a little bit of having those higher payments.
And let me thank you, Jerry, for the call. We're coming to the end of this hour, and I want to end by asking any of the panelists to answer a question from a listener named Ben, who says, we'd like to buy right now, but we're very scared that we're paying too much and because the market is not sustainable, that we're going to lose out on any investment we might have. Can somebody talk about the sustainability of the housing market and if it can keep going?
So I think my, as you generously called it, my sage advice at the top of the hour is to think about, could I handle this situation if house prices went down by 5 or 10%? And think about, I can't put a precise chance on that happening, but I think anyone that's getting in a house right now wants to make sure that their family financial situation is going to be robust to any kind of minor decline.
We'll leave it there with your sage advice. Thank you, Christopher Palmer, who is assistant professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. We also want to thank Kathleen Pender, who also joins us in studio for this hour, business columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. Her column is called Net Worth. And thanks to Selma Happ, who joined us from Los Angeles, chief economist with the Pacific Union International. And thanks, of course, to you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion. We encourage you to do so online, kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineers are Katie McMurrin and Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Jeremy Siegel and Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.